announcements. I'll make them right now and then repeat them after we're done here. And the first one is, there is a sign-up sheet on the registration table right outside the dining room for those who want to go on the outing on Sunday afternoon. So you can read about it in your conference program. Those who want to go on the outing, the sisters need to know, have a count of how many. There also will be a sign-up sheet on the same table to sign up for Holy Hours of Adoration tonight for the all-night vigil before the Blessed Sacrament. So those are two important things to sign up for. All right, I'll go through a few of mine and then pass the microphone on to another priest. Will you please all keep in your prayers my efforts to bring the Holy Rosary to prisoners? There is a Saint Dismas to pray with us, or to pray for that intention. So it's not so much a question as a request for all of us. A lot of intentions, of course, for us to remember, but it just reminds us what Our Lady said at Fatima, that we should all pray and sacrifice for the conversion of sinners. Another one, could a deceased priest come down from heaven and say Mass? And the answer is no. Very simple answer that. Of course, there is no Mass in heaven. There's no need for the Mass in heaven. The souls are there enjoying the beatific vision. But once a priest has passed away, he would not be able, even if he were revived, to say Mass. You traditionalists are stuck in the mud who refuse to change with the times. So it's not as much a question, but I think the person who wrote that is saying, how would you refute that? And my simple answer is, yes, the times change, but the doctrines of the faith don't. And this was a common theme that was drilled into the people at the time of Vatican II. Well, we have to keep up with the times. Well, yes, in the sense that the church has to answer new heresies, new false ideas that occur with the times, but that doesn't mean the doctrine can change. If congregational singing is desired, should the melody be pitched to the average male voice, baritone? Whoever wrote that, you're thinking along my own thinking. So I always lead a hymn on Sunday after Mass, and sometimes the organist starts, you know, with a note they want me to start on. So I've told the choir directors, tell the organist I will start where I want to start it. But the reason is because I know if you start it too high, then the men just drop out and the women have to take it over. So, you know, it's a good point. But the answer to that would be that is a pastoral issue, meaning the priest, you know, some priests maybe don't have that as a custom. But I think congregational singing is a beautiful thing. As Father pointed out, St. Augustine says, singing is praying twice. And in fact, he doesn't know this yet. I was going to ask Father Philip to do part two next year, because there are several things that could be brought out about church music, such as that, the beauty of congregational singing. You know, we made at our church a little hymn book that the people could join in, and especially when we have the school masses, we have the hymns chosen ahead of time, and keep encouraging the children to join in and sing the hymns during Mass. It helps them to attend Mass better. Here's another one. Please explain or clarify the clear difference between FSSP, Fraternity of St. Peter, and SSPX, and what Sedevacantists hold to be true. And I'll start with the last part. Father Riesling made the point that he doesn't really like people calling him a Sedevacantist, because he said, I'm a Catholic. I'm a Roman Catholic. And that's what we are. We have just recognized that there's no way these modern so-called popes could be popes, but we're Catholics. But that term, Sedevacantist, was coined by someone and referring to those who hold that the chair of Peter is vacant. They just make that logical conclusion. But the Fraternity of St. Peter was founded in, I think, 1988 or 89, and what happened is when Archbishop Lefebvre finally decided to consecrate four of his priests to be bishops, he was excommunicated. And there were priests in his fraternity of St. Pius X who did not want to fall under that punishment, because they firmly believed that John Paul II was a true pope. So they went to John Paul II and they said, will you give us an organization under you that would allow us to say the Latin Tridentine Mass? So John Paul II formed the Fraternity of St. Peter. But the difference between Fraternity of St. Peter and Society of St. Pius X, both of them say that Francis is a true pope, but Fraternity of St. Peter are under him. They obey him. They're under the local diocese. They have the local bishop come and confirm their children. Whereas the Society of St. Pius X says Francis is a pope, but they totally ignore him, and they operate their own apostolate without recognizing the local ordinaries, supposed ordinaries, that are under or serving at Francis's behest, the bishops of the diocese. They just ignore them and carry on their own apostolate. So that would be the difference between them. Okay, I'll pass the mic.
The first one I have says, Father Philip, your opinion on music with lots of bass or deep bass sounds that reverberate. So, just really quickly, my aunt lived, she thankfully moved, on a street corner of two busy streets in a house that was a little old, had kind of old windows. Every single time I was over there, a car would be at the stoplight, and it would have this bass boost that would make the windows rattle beyond control. It was unbearable. So my first thought is, that is extremely selfish, that you're imposing your own strange tastes on everybody around you. Though we have to say, I think that there is a basis, even in biology, like we talked about in the lecture a little bit. Everything that I talked about in the lecture was kind of really scratching the surface. I think that for those sort of heavy bass drops, it does correspond very well with our fallen nature. It appeals to bass instincts, not to confuse the two meanings of the word there. But you don't see heavy bass and those sort of obnoxious beats in sacred music, ever. So that should be some sort of indication. I think that it appeals very much to the fallen nature, and it should be avoided. It's one of those things that it can be satisfying. Some of those people out there call themselves music files. They love to analyze the details and the qualities of music, and they love the rich bass sound. Now, I have to say, the bishop gave me permission when I was in Minnesota to buy a humongous subwoofer for the organ. We put it on the organ because the organ was kind of lacking. You need those pedal notes. You need the pedal notes to give a foundation to this glorious music. But of course, it's not percussive. So it's a matter of discernment, as I think I mentioned in the lecture. We can know when we hear it something that's kind of bass and carnal. And for the most part, that rap music, I say with air quotes, didn't touch on that in the lecture. It's garbage. So, one more question here. This says, I'll never see my deceased pets again, not even in heaven. Why not? Why won't we be sad about it? It might sound like a funny question on the surface, but it's a good question. We have these joys that were given here on earth, legitimate joys. Pets are, they're wonderful. They can be companions, and they're a true gift from God. But they don't have immortal souls. We know that because they don't have immortal souls, they won't be in heaven with us. There's, I think, a utility, though, in trying to imagine whatever can make you happiest. We know that heaven consists in the beatific vision. There will not be room for little things. I mean, we might consider in that context, pets would be kind of a little thing. But remember, when when you're a child, you think in kind of, you know, simpler terms, you know, mommy, when I get to heaven, can I eat as many Snicker bars as I want? Of course you can. You know, it just helps to set the imagination on how good heaven is. But the closer we get to God, hopefully the more we'll understand the beatific vision is everything. Seeing God face to face is all that we'll want, and there will be not even the recollection of the things that we enjoyed on earth, I think, as far as those little things like pets. So I'm going to pass the microphone on now to Father Casimir.
All right. Regarding something Father Benedict was answering about not pitching the music too high, one of our choir directors here at the Mount, Mr. Tim Duff, has a saying, from sea to shining sea. You know, just from the high sea to the low sea, that's just the good range. So, anyway, during the ladies' retreat, I heard that there are more souls released from purgatory on the feasts of the Assumption and Christmas. Is this true? And if so, why? I believe the source for this is that excellent book on purgatory by Father Shoup, written in the 1800s. It was reprinted by Tan. I don't know if it's been reprinted again, but I believe in there, Father Shoup refers to a tradition, or maybe it was a private revelation, that on the day of her actual assumption into heaven, just in celebration of the feast, everybody got released from purgatory that day. And then every year on the anniversary of her assumption, as we consider time here on earth, she releases a number of souls equal to the population of Rome. So Father Shoup would be the authority that I would refer to on that. I don't know about Christmas. I don't remember reading that. Does anybody else remember that being Christmas Day, being a day for great release? But it seems very fitting on the Assumption Day that our Blessed Mother, she's our, you know, the children in the souls in purgatory are her children, and she just wants more of them there for her festivity. So. So you can, I do recommend that book, especially during November. It's very good. Next question. Can you please expound a bit on invincible ignorance? Who is invincibly ignorant as opposed to being culpably ignorant? Invincibly comes from the Latin meaning, well, vincibilis means overcomable. Invincibilis means unovercomable. So invincible ignorance is when people don't know and they don't know any better. Culpable ignorance is where they refuse to find out. And obviously culpable ignorance is sinful, because you're not, it's like, I wonder if today is Friday, because in that case I would not be able to eat meat, but I'll turn the calendar around so I don't find out. That's willful ignorance. That's refusing to find, or just not refusing to ask, take some kind of reasonable means to find out. But I believe it's true to say that invincible ignorance of itself, Pope Pius IX said they're not guilty of that thing insofar as that matter itself is concerned, but it's still not enough to save somebody's soul, because one has to have supernatural faith to get to heaven. One has to have perfect contrition if one has committed mortal sin. One cannot enter the heaven without those. So, and there's always that duty to study, the duty to seek the truth. So is there such a person that's 100% invincibly ignorant? I don't think so, because we have a duty to seek the truth. We know that. We can't just sit back and say, I refuse to find out. So those seek and you shall find, knock and it shall be opened to you. And I think to this day how Father Krzysztof, he was raised as an atheist, and he sought to find the truth. He became a Catholic. He was baptized in Moscow, Russia in 1988 when the persecution was still very strong. And then on top of that, he found a vocation of the priesthood. He was ordained here at the Mount in 2008. Seek and you shall find. He sought and it was given to him. So I think that I hope that's the adequate insofar as an explanation. I'll answer one more question, then I'll pass on the microphone. Does Portugal still have the faith as Our Lady of Fatima predicted? Well, that's right there. I read it. As part of the second secret or the second part, that in Portugal, the dogma of the faith will always be kept. But we know that Vatican II has taken over Portugal as it's taken over all other places in the world. And more on the personal level or the family level, people have the faith. But, you know, Vatican II has destroyed faith and morals there to a very great extent. So I think all we can be assured of is that in individual cases, there will still be faithful Portuguese. And there's still a very strong sense of devotion and love for Our Lady. That country has its problems, but there's a real sense of devotion and faith that's there. So maybe that's what Our Lady was referring to. And I also know, for example, in the Azores Islands, there's a very strong devotion to the Holy Trinity or to the Holy Ghost. A visitor that went there told me he saw shrines to the Holy Ghost all over the place. So things like that would seem to be the fulfillment of that promise of Our Lady that the doctrine of the dogma of the faith will always be preserved.
This is my first time running this gauntlet, so do the best we can. Feels like interrogation with these lights up here. My friend says she can speak in tongues, and she says she can interpret other people speaking in tongues. What is the Catholic understanding of this so-called gift of the Holy Ghost? So I'll answer that in two parts. First, what is true speaking in tongues? What was the purpose of it? And secondly, how do we recognize false speaking in tongues? So obviously the gift of tongues, it's mentioned in the times in the Bible, in the times when the church first began to spread, the time of the apostles, and it was the gift where you could speak and it'd be understood in multiple different languages, and that was for the benefit of spreading the faith. But St. Paul complains about those who claim to speak in tongues but are not understood by others. So speaking in tongues is utterly pointless if it's not understood. And St. Paul said that tongues would cease. And so we don't have speaking in tongues now. It's not necessary for the spreading of the faith. Now, how do you recognize, how do you say that those that claim, like the Pentecostals, claim they can speak in tongues? Well, first of all, again, the purpose of it is not, nobody really understands what they're saying. Now, someone can make it up and say, oh, I understood what he was saying, but they're just making it up. And how can you, well, one way you can respond is, as a Catholic, we know it's false. Why? Because we have a certitude about the faith. And so we know anything that is contrary to the faith is false. So, you know, if it's just sort of like if someone comes up to you with a book that they wrote that they said it proves that 2 plus 2 is 5, and you would say, no, I'm not interested in reading your book. They'd say, because it's 4. And they'd say, but how do you know? You didn't read my book yet. Well, you're wrong, sorry. Because I already know it's 4, and you'll never convince me it's 5, and I don't need to read your book to know your book is wrong. But non-Catholics don't, when it comes to faith, they don't understand certitude, because in non-Catholics' minds, when they say faith, what they really mean is opinion. When we say faith, we mean certitude, because God revealed what we believe, and God could never deceive us. It's like a non-Catholic on the plane once. He was a Protestant talk show host. He spoke with me across the aisle for about the whole hour and a half flight. And at the end, he said to me, well, I can see I'm not going to convince you, and you're not going to convince me, so how about this? You pray for me that I'll come to a full knowledge of the truth. This is him speaking. And he said, and I'll pray for you that you come to a full knowledge of the truth. I said, no. And he was kind of shocked. You don't want prayers. You don't want the truth. I said, so you don't understand what faith is, because faith gives you certitude. It's believing what God revealed. And as soon as you tell me, pray for me that I come to a full knowledge of the truth, what you're telling me is that what you currently believe is not faith, it's just your opinion, which you think might be wrong. And if I said, yes, you can pray for me, I'm saying I don't have faith. So, but then there's another interesting thing with this gift of tongues, so-called, is they've done studies where those who are supposedly speaking in other languages, other tongues, what they're really doing is using vowel sounds and accents from their own language. A Frenchman supposedly speaking in tongues is doing so in French. An Englishman is doing it in English. And that is proof that it's false. It's not really speaking another language. It's just using your own language and butchering it. So, in what manner should you weigh the distractions during prayers, mass, to be a sin or not? Very good question. I always think of something that Father Faber said in one of his books. And if you know Father Faber, once you read something in one of his books, you can never find it again. So I don't know what book it's in. But he said, distractions in our prayers are probably one of the things for which we are, of all our faults, one of the things for which we are least responsible. Because it is just something even the saints struggled with, and our imagination, as St. Francis de Sales says, is just simply, it's not the same thing as your free will, and it's not always under control. And thoughts come and go, and we can do the best we can, but we just simply cannot avoid all distractions. I think it was St. Aloysius Gonzaga, if I'm not mistaken, that tried to pray three Hail Marys in a row without a single distraction, and it took him all night. And it'd be very imprudent for us to try it, but whatever it was, Father says it was a holy hour, so I don't want to be inventing any apocryphal stories. But the point is, if it's difficult for the saints, it's certainly difficult for us. However, I think sometimes we do have to remember that when it comes to sin, there's what's not only directly sinful, that is directly willed, but we are responsible, or can be, for things what we call voluntary in cause. So if you're driving 100 miles an hour through a neighborhood and you kill someone, you can't say, well, I didn't intend to kill them. You say, well, you knew that driving 100 miles an hour, you were liable to cause that. So it's voluntary in cause. And sometimes our distractions and prayers can be because we didn't properly prepare for our prayers. And so that's what we can and we should work on. I wouldn't worry so much about whether it's a sin or not with the distractions, but what we can and should do is try to work on removing the cause of the distractions the best we can. And then the Last Supper was the first Mass, correct? That's correct. In each Mass, Jesus Christ dies mystically. Did he mystically think some word missing. Did he mystically die in the Last Supper, or was the sacrifice concluded on Calvary? So the correct terminology is that the Mass is a real but mystical sacrifice. And there are some very fine points among theologians as how they explain that. But as the Council of Trent teaches, Christ died once on the cross. He doesn't suffer again in every Mass. So it is the same sacrifice, but as the Council of Trent says, the manner in which it is offered is different. It is an unbloody renewal of the sacrifice of the cross, and the Last Supper, being the first Mass, was also, but in that case it was in anticipation of the offering of himself he would make on the cross. And lastly here, why do servers kiss the cruets during Mass? So that's just simply a mark of reverence. A kiss has always been that. Do other things liturgically as well.
Okay, I guess we'll just keep it going this way, and I'll just do two questions here, and then so we get the more of the variety here among the four of us. Do you think the mark of the beast is soon upon us? And as it says in the Bible, you cannot buy or sell without it, and those who take the mark are damned. Now, this is in the apocalypse, and the there's a great deal of symbolism in the apocalypse, and we have to be careful before we take something literally. And as far as I know, the church hasn't given a lot of a definitive interpretation of the apocalypse, and has let it stand as a book to remind us or to teach us the sufferings of the church through the centuries, the triumphs and trials, and of course at the end will be the greatest. So that comes across very clearly. But that having been said, with modern technology, it's amazing, and it's even frightening to think of the things that they're coming up with. Artificial intelligence, holographs, and I believe already there are places in the world where people have inserted a chip under the skin. I'm not sure how well that can actually work or survive. In itself, it just apart from this, I mean, if somebody did that and they were like went in and out of a facility and scanned themselves in, I mean, of itself, that's just technology. That's just science. That's just using an invention. But if it were ever to be that by accepting this chip, you are acknowledging the Antichrist or, you know, some form of idolatry, then under pain of death, we'd have to reject it. And I don't know how it's going to be, you know, pushed in that regard. But as I said, of itself, it's just technology. But if it's used in any way to, well, first of all, it's a matter of privacy, too. That doesn't belong in anybody's body. You really would lose tremendous amount of privacy. And that's a God-given right. And it should be a political and social right as well. So of itself, not sinful as I can see it. I don't think it's a good idea. I do think you give up a great deal of your personal liberty. It should never be forced. And if it was ever linked with, you know, you're giving homage to anyone other than the true God, then absolutely has to be rejected. I do remember listening to a talk by Bishop Sambor, and he was commenting on the apocalypse. And now, it's like that saying from what Father Gabriel said, once you read something in Father Faber, you're probably never going to find it again. And of all the recorded talks of Bishop Sambor, I don't know that I could find it again, but he was quoting St. Jerome, who was emphasizing how highly symbolic most of the apocalypse, if not almost all of it, is a symbolic thing. And of course, it's the revealed word of God, but we have to be careful and always seek to see if there is an official interpretation the church gives us. That's what gives us safety and security and guides us. We don't interpret the Bible for ourselves. How do we act in charity towards the LGBT? We know, of course, or there's a, I guess another question or follow-up. More, do we, I'm not sure of the question here, who to, it's something about, you know, how do we judge this? Well, in itself, it's a grave sin, and it's a perversion of the procreative power that God has given. And we can never approve of sin. And I believe St. Augustine's advice is very wise here. He says, hate the sin, not the sinner. And of course, they're not going to understand that. If you don't accept their sin, they're going to say, you're hating me. No, make the distinction. I hate the sin, not the sinner. You can have a very good friend that's about to do something really bad, and you tell that person, no, I'm not going to agree with what you're going to do because I love you. I think that's how we should portray it, but we should never compromise with sin, but pray for these people that they can turn it around. And there are, I've read more than just a few cases of people who, corresponding with God's grace, gave up that very sinful lifestyle. We will never do what is, seems to be likely to happen in the Vatican II Church with the synod and synodality, which is an acknowledging sin, giving blessing to sin. That is so evil. We can never do that. So,
Avira says, how are we to feel about modern day Christian music? So I assume what is meant by this is like Christian rock. They have sort of a light version of rock or sometimes even a folk type of music. A couple of thoughts here. One thing to consider is that the church has always very carefully regulated music because it pertains to God. Particularly in the liturgy, it's the official worship of Almighty God, but still we're talking about a very holy thing. Some of the recent writings of the popes, again, would love to mention this in a lecture. There's so much to talk about with music. Pope St. Pius the X issued a motu proprio. Was it La Se Solicitudini? Was that the one? Tra Le Solicitudini. Pope Pius the XII, an encyclical, Musice Sacre. The church has always regulated very carefully religious music, and I think the intention with this Christian rock, so to say, is to bring what is profane, that is the style of the music, and lift it to something that is good. And so we can understand the intention. Maybe the intention is good, but I think the effect is actually the opposite. They bring something that is good and holy down to the profane. So I think that being the case, we don't need to listen to that kind of music. I doubt that it is sinful. You know, we have to hope and even assume that the intention of the artist is to do something good. But we owe God better, and the church has always been a guide. What is the music exactly? And the popes, again, in these writings that I mentioned, they really lay out specifically style. What are even some pieces to be emulated? The religious music should try to follow the Gregorian chant that is ancient, etc. So I think that this Christian music, this Christian rock, is really something that should be avoided. Another question here. I look on YouTube for music to listen to. Is all sacred music safe to listen to? On TV, movies, etc., not all are okay. So what music to listen to? There, of course, there are contemporary composers that will take a stab, I guess. They write music for these sacred texts. And they're not, of course, they're not necessarily to be trusted because of kind of the way that modernism has just saturated what has always been Catholic. And I could give specific examples. It's music that I can just say plainly would not be okay with Pope St. Pius X. So not all music that has the label sacred is fitting. So you need to be discerning there. Go back to the well-known Catholic composers. There are some of the big names, Giovanni Palestrina, the Prince of Music. There's Thomas Luis de Vitoria, who was a contemporary, who was a priest, a very good holy priest, wrote. I think between just these two composers, there's more than 200 works. So they were very prolific, beautiful, beautiful music. And not to say that every modern composition is bad. We have a good friend of ours, Nicholas Wilton, who writes beautiful music that can be used in the liturgical setting. There's a favorite of mine is Felix Nam Quae Es. Absolutely stunning. And he wrote this only a few years ago. So a bit of a rambling answer here, but I would say one little benefit that I found with technology, YouTube somewhat, but there are some other platforms that have algorithms. You put in something you know is good, put in Palestrina, put in Vittoria, and it will do a pretty good job of finding you very similar things. So you can do this with sacred music or that other innocent music that we talked about in the lecture. So there are some tools there at your disposal. But again, you know, be discerning, and if there's a doubt or something doesn't seem right, well, look it up or just find something that is good. There's plenty available.
What are the prayers the bishop prays after the last gospel of the Pontifical High Mass? Very good question. So in the front of the altar missal, there are prayers for a priest to say before Mass and after Mass, Latin prayers, some of them written by St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, etc. And those are also found in our breviaries in the back. And most of them are ad libitum. They're optional. But there are prayers after Mass which begin with an antiphon, Trium Puerorum, and then there's the Benedicite Omnia Opera Domini Domino. It's the prayer that the three young men prayed in the fiery furnace that you find in the book of Daniel the prophet. So they're calling upon all of creation to bless God. And added to that is a psalm, and then you repeat the antiphon, and then there's a few, an Our Father, a few versicles and responses, and then three orations. So that is actually obligatory, but as we say, sub leve, for priests to pray after Mass. So any good excuse, like a priest has a sick call, someone wants to see the priest and he can't keep that person waiting too long, etc., would excuse the priest from praying it. But in the rubrics, when the bishop has a pontifical Mass, as you noticed, it has him pray those prayers at the throne after Mass. So the beautiful Latin prayers of thanksgiving. What is the significance of the blue knotted cord that CMRI priests wear with their habits? Well, first of all, of course, we're a total Marian congregation. The sisters wear blue and white, the colors of Our Lady. So we male religious priests and brothers have a white habit. The brown scapular is Our Lady of Mount Carmel, but we have to fit in the blue. So we have a blue cord for the miraculous medal, but we also have the blue cincture. Now on the cincture, one end has three larger knots, and quite obviously those signify the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. The other end has two smaller knots, And those signify total consecration to Jesus through Mary, as taught by St. Louis Marie de Montfort, which isn't a vow, but is a solemn promise, I think we could say, consecrating ourselves to our Blessed Mother. That is our spirituality. And the other small knot signifies fraternal charity, the importance of us maintaining among ourselves the bond of charity among our religious. And this is related, but a different question. Why do the male religious sometimes wear their habits and sometimes just the clerical garb, or I think the person meant to say the habit? I'm sorry, the cassock, the black cassock. The reason why we don't wear that religious habit all the time is because it gets dirty very easily, white color. So that's why we alternate with the black cassock. And the clerical garb, I think, is what the person may be referring to as what we would call clericals, wearing a black suit with a collar when we go into town, because the Third Council of Baltimore commanded that in the United States, priests and male religious were not to wear their habits in public. They would wear a suit with clericals. Okay, this one has about five questions, but I'll do them quickly. Do you think Jesus minds if we look at and appreciate the beauty and symmetry of the flowers and decorations on or near the altar? No. As long as it doesn't become a preoccupation, all right? Does he mind one who comes before him and can't help but cry? No, our Lord does not mind. For joy to be with him after missing him or because of troubles, part of the, you know, emotional time. And of course, God made us as we are, and we are all different. And I'm sure that God appreciates the love in the heart that prompts whatever the type of prayer that the person prays. How can we grow in love for our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament, especially those who live far enough away that visits are not possible except perhaps on Sunday? So two things there. Well, three things. One, to read the beautiful book that I recommend is called The Blessed Eucharist by Father Michael Mueller, to help to foster devotion to the Blessed Sacrament. There's a book on the Blessed Sacrament by Father Faber, Saint Alphonsus Liguori, etc. So these are helpful. But in the book by Father Mueller, he has a whole chapter on spiritual communions. You can only receive a sacramental communion once a day, but you can make spiritual communions throughout the day. Another practice I recommend is what Father Matteo promoted, called the night adoration in the home. It would be dangerous, difficult, or the church is locked, to go and make a holy hour in the middle of the night or late at night. But you could make a nocturnal hour of adoration in your home. So that's something that he promoted. But thirdly, I would say keep in mind the value of using the technology we have today, namely the internet. And some here have mentioned to me how they watch the Mass on our website, which is miqparish.org. That's the website that this Fatima conference is being live streamed on. But it's easy to remember. MIQ stands for Mary Immaculate Queen, and then the word parish. So miqparish.org, not .com, .org, for a nonprofit organization. But we have Mass live streamed every day. So someone who lives away from where Mass is or can't get to the church could watch it that's taking place right at that time on the internet, use your missal, follow, and again, making a spiritual communion. So those would be wonderful ways to foster that devotion to the Blessed Sacrament.
Oh, I've just have one more. What is the best way to spread the rosary to the people in general, especially without a regular church close by? The block rosary is still, I think, a wonderful way to practice the rosary devotion, and because you share it among your neighbors. So it was a devotion that was instituted during World War II. Mary Hall was a resident of Michigan, I think in Detroit possibly, and her brother was fighting in one of the worst battles of World War II, Iwo Jima, and Our Lady appeared to her or gave her just an internal locution or something along those lines, and and just said, get your neighbors and pray the rosary. Again, there's always a multiplier effect. The more people are praying the rosary with you, you're all increasing each other's power of prayer. So the ideal of the block rosary is actually to go from home to home every evening, you know, and pray the rosary. It might be hard to do in our modern circumstances, but I would say at least once a week, pray the block rosary, get your neighbors to come, even if they're not Catholics. This would be a means for conversion. I know there are block rosary homes here in our parish, and I very much encourage those to keep on going. Another one is rosary marches. We typically have one downtown on the 13th of the month from May to October. We're not doing it today because our candlelight procession is here, but that helps promote the rosary. I remember when I first went to Boston about 20 years ago, I was edified by some of the devout traditional Catholics there who would make it a practice every Sunday. They would go and visit another Novus Ordo parish and hand out rosaries and scapulars. I mean, they were very zealous, and you know, being Vatican II, they scarcely seemed to know what it was or what to do with it, but here they were spreading the devotion to the rosary and scapular to these Vatican II Catholics, and it can only help them. So those are a few ways that come to my mind. When you're traveling, have rosaries and scapulars to give, but only if you know that people are going to use them properly. I was always, one last point, I was really edified by the late Mr. Jim Schindler. Many of you remember him. He died a couple of years ago, but he had a very good habit of sharing the green scapular with people and giving it out to them. And green scapulars are especially fitting for non-Catholics to help them in their conversion process. So just a few ways that come to my mind for spreading devotion to the rosary.
I've got two more questions here I'll answer, but I got to thinking on the question of kissing the cruets during Mass. I probably wasn't too clear. They're kissed out of reverence for not the cruets, but for the one who's receiving them, who you're giving them to the priest. So it's out of reverence to the priest. There are other things we kiss out of reverence for the thing itself, like when you receive a blessed candle or palm. But this is different in the liturgy. Oftentimes an item is kissed before it's handed to the person. You'll see that, for example, if you noticed when the bishop was given the crozier during the Pontifical Mass. So this question I'm not going to be able to be too helpful with, and that is, what is the Portiuncula indulgence? I read about it in the book Our Lady by Father Lassance. There was no explanation in Our Lady book. So that would be a very good question for a Franciscan, because it is a very special indulgence. What I do know is a very special indulgence attached to the little chapel, the Portiuncula, associated with the beginning of with St. Francis and the beginning of the Franciscan order, and St. Francis on his deathbed commended it to the care of his order, and it's something, a visit to that chapel has been highly indulgenced by multiple popes over the centuries. And so I'm sure it's a plenary indulgence. I don't know the conditions other than a visit to that little chapel. And you'll often see it mentioned, I believe, because over the centuries, obviously most people in the world cannot go to visit that chapel. So the popes have given different ways in which you can gain the same Portiuncula indulgence without actually going there. And actually, if any of you are from the East Coast, in Washington, D.C., I've been there a couple times, there is the Monastery of the Holy Sepulchre, where they have a replica of the Portiuncula Chapel, built to the same size and dimensions, as well as a number of replicas also to the same dimensions as some of the shrines in the Holy Land. So that's something interesting to see. Sadly, it's Novus Ordo now. And this last question is one that I've done a lot of research on, and it's a very good question, so I thank whoever asked it. Is the 3 days of darkness something the church believes? And the short and very simple is no. Answer is no. It's not. It was never approved by the church, and there is no authentic source for it. You see it attributed to a number of holy persons, canonized or otherwise, but none of them have proven an authentic source. And the one where it's most often attributed to, and you'll see all over the internet a whole lengthy paragraph of this so-called prophecy, is Blessed Anna Maria Teigi. And she is a blessed from the 1800s, but I looked into that extensively some years ago, and this never came from her. It's quoted in quotes as if it's her verbatim, her exact words. You'll see it all over the internet, but you'll never see a source for it. And what it turned out to be is it was someone who said they heard it from someone who said they heard it from her. And I think it might have even been one more person in the line there. I can't remember. But there's, you know, it's not intellectually honest to put the whole paragraph in quote marks as if it was verbatim hers. Now, she was known for having prophecies, and it's a very common thing with false prophecies for whoever made them up to attribute them to a saint who was known for having a prophetic spirit, because that makes them more likely to be received. And so, but her prophecies, Pius IX discussed her prophecies in an address in the 1800s, and he said the church has made no judgment on them, and they are with the keeping of the Sacred Congregation of Rites for the process of her canonization. And so we don't actually know what her prophecies were, but we do know that this one has no authentic source going back to her. It is mere hearsay. And why you see it today very often on the internet is because of two books, I believe it's in both of them, that are very common. They became very popular in the 1970s, 80s, after Vatican II, and that is the book, it's Catholic Prophecy, and then the other one, I think, Prophecy for Our Times. A lot of people think those are good collections of legitimate Catholic prophecies, and they may have some that are legitimate. But if you look in the bibliography for those books, they are full of known sources of false prophecies, and they reference books that are collections of false prophecies that have already been proven false because the time when they were supposed to be fulfilled is gone. For example, there was a supposed prophecy attributed to St. John Vianney saying that the world will end, he supposedly said, before the church has a chance to canonize me. Well, obviously that it didn't happen. So the book where this is taken from is a French book. That's what those two books in English I mentioned. They take it from a French book, which I'm going to butcher the French if I try to pronounce it, but it's Prophetic Voice is what the title translates to, and it was a known source of false prophecies from the 1800s, many of which have been proven false, including the 3 days of darkness, because here's the thing. I'll read you what the French book said. I'll read it to you here. I've got an English translation. This is what the actual prophecy supposedly said. First of all, she supposedly said Pius IX's reign would last only 27 years. Well, that was false because it was actually 32 years. So already false. She supposedly prophesied that he would live to see the triumph of the church in spite of the calamities. And so this is the prophecy. All the enemies of the church, hidden or open, will perish during the days of darkness, with the exception of some few whom God will convert immediately afterwards. The air will then be infected by the demons, who will appear under all kinds of hideous shapes. The possession of a blessed candle will secure its owner from death. So also will the saying of prayers addressed to our Blessed Lady and the holy angels. So far, that's where you get the prophecy supposedly attributed to her. But here's the part that those two English books deliberately left out, and this is very dishonest of the authors of those books. That's why you should not rely on those books. After the 3 days of darkness, Saints Peter and Paul, having come down from heaven, will preach throughout the world and will designate the new pope, Lumen in Caelo, who is to succeed Pius IX. A great light will flash from their bodies and will settle upon the cardinal, the future pontiff. Saint Michael, the archangel, appearing then upon earth in human form, will hold the devil enchained until the period of the preaching of Antichrist. In these days, religion shall extend its empire throughout the world. There shall be one shepherd. The Russians will be converted, as well as England and China, and all the faithful, filled with joy in beholding this overwhelming triumph of the church. After the days of darkness, the Holy House of Loretto will be carried by angels to Rome and will be deposited in the Basilica of St. Mary Major. So all of that was supposed to happen, the 3 days during the reign of Pius IX, and then the next pope after him, there was supposed to be this wonderful conversion of the whole world. That would have been Leo XIII. The reference to Lumen in Caelo, incidentally, is actually taken from another false prophecy, the so-called St. Malachy prophecy, which was really written centuries after it is after St. Malachy. But so here's the thing, is that you can see that 3 days was already proven false when it didn't happen under Pius IX and Leo XIII. And sadly, it's been dug up again after Vatican II, but they left out the part that proves that it was false. And that's not, unfortunately, what happens, it's done repeatedly through history. Whenever there's a time of great turmoil in the church, Catholics make the mistake of they want to know answers. They want to know what's going to happen. They no longer rest satisfied with the faith. They start looking into prophecies to satisfy their curiosity about things that God does not want us to know. And so always these false prophecies, they crop up in large numbers. It happened during the Protestant revolt. It happened in the 1800s. Pius IX said there's an awful lot of prophecies going around these days. This is around the time of Vatican I. And he said most of them don't deserve the honor of being read. And he said, and this is very important, Pius IX said, prophecy for us is to do the will of God. And so remember that true prophecy, true private revelation is never for the purpose of satisfying curiosity about future things. It is only to reiterate what we know by faith. And the idea that we would need some special knowledge that we can only gain by prophecy, such as this blessed candle, the idea that we are going to need additional knowledge that is not part of our faith in order to be saved someday is not Catholic.
Almost done. I have three more. And we'll end with these. When the 33-day preparation for consecration to Jesus through Mary, do you always start on the same day? For instance, when the Feast of the Queenship is delayed this year, June 5th, do you still start your preparation on April 28th? Well, obviously, you can do whatever you wish. Some people who maybe made their total consecration on February 2nd or December 8th will do the 33 days before that. I did with our religious, we still did it starting on April 28th and then renewed our total consecration on May 31st, even though the Feast of the Queenship was moved to after the Octave of Pentecost. But it's, you know, it's certainly, there's no, you know, necessary way to do it. Renewing it every year is a wonderful thing. Here's another one. When Father Dennis gave public lectures, he would lead the rosary before it, praying both the first and second parts of the Hail Mary out loud to keep people from running away with the second part. Sometimes the Hail Mary is led without pause, person, you know, going right through. One lady here said her mother was converted because of the way Father Dennis prayed the rosary. Before a reform is called on prayer or before there is a point of no return, should the Hail Mary be said publicly with pause before first and second parts? Again, that would be up to the priest in charge in each parish, but some people can get to the point where you're saying the rosary and it just sounds like the speaking in tongues, it sounds like the everybody's on a different pace. And it is beautiful when it's being prayed in unison. And to pray in unison, there does need to be occasional pauses. So that would be up to the priest to do in the parishes so that the people are praying the rosary more becomingly and in an edifying way and more devoutly. Last question. Is it conceivable that God would ever allow all bishops and therefore all priests to die out? Would he be breaking his promise to be with us to the end of the world? And does that promise mean that he will be with us in the Blessed Sacrament until the end of the world? So you're aware that our Lord, the last thing he said before he ascended into heaven on Ascension Thursday, is he said to the apostles, "Behold, I am with you all days, even unto the consummation of the world." So how is he with us and how will he be with his church? I believe in two ways, in the Blessed Sacrament, and also he is in his church through the priests and keeping the faith alive. So I don't believe that the priesthood could die out. And same thing, you could apply it to the papacy. We're not saying the papacy is over. I think there are some that think there will never be a true pope again, and I can't see that because the church must always endure as Christ established it. And the papacy is part of the nature of the church. Well, likewise, the sacraments. If all priests died out and there were no sacraments at all, that would, to me, be a contradiction to Christ's promise and the indefectibility of the church. Now, Father Gabriel talking about prophecy, one thing that I have read somewhere, but I have to find it, is that some believe, based on the apocalypse, I think Father Sylvester Berry might explain part of the apocalypse this way, is that there may be a time when there won't be mass anywhere for a short time, maybe even that 3 years, 3.5 years at the time of Antichrist, where there will be priests, but maybe they will be imprisoned or will not be able to offer mass. I don't know if that would be the case, but if it is, there still have to be priests in the world. There has to be a bishop so that the sacraments would be able to continue. So that's my thoughts on that. But again, the bottom line is we have to believe in the indefectibility of the church. In the words of our Lord, the gates of hell will not prevail. The devil is being very successful, as you've heard in several different lectures, but the church will live on, does live on, and Christ is with his church and will be until the end of time. So we thank you for your attention, and we're done for the day here until this evening. So once again, I'll read the schedule, and it says that